The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Advice and expertise on the relief you need from hay fever at All Care Community Pharmacies across Ireland.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. You know, I think if we've learned one thing in the last year and a half is that life is a very dangerous thing and you're best off avoiding it if you can. And the front page of the Irish Daily Mail today has... Do you know the way yesterday we were told that the older people coming into A&E were the problem? Today we're hearing that it's staycationers clogging up emergency departments. They are falling off cliffs, hills, walls, and there are a lot of child injuries. Paul Reid is inside in the Irish Mail on Sunday actually warning about the dangers of staycations. So we have now realised there is danger everywhere and everything you do is dangerous. And I'd say we'll be warned about everything all the time now. The Sunday Times... So basically, the Sunday Times front page story, you believe this or not, is that they're having to put CCTV footage into the houses of the Oireachtas to make sure that people are turning up for work. That's the nuts and bolts of it. CCTV to check on senators and TDs fobbing in. Not only to check if they're turning up for work, but to check if they're not getting someone else to fob in for them to say that they have turned up to work. This is in our parliament. That's what they have to do. The Business Post, so they have HSE chief hails final countdown as government signals easing of COVID restrictions. So that's Paul Reid saying it's the final countdown. Tony Houlihan saying we're hitting a turning point. They're talking about further easing of restrictions in autumn with live events, nightclubs and sporting events all seeing capacities gradually restored, the abolition of the COVID certs for indoor hospitality and winding down mass vaccination centres, all of that stuff happening. Like, you know, it sounds like they're planning on a return to normal this autumn. The Sunday Independent, minister is rumbled in extraordinary leak ruse. This is Miriam Lord was writing about this yesterday, that somebody, a junior minister, as the Sunday Independent reveals today, basically did a Agatha Christie, if you know what that is, on a senior minister to find out who leaked live from the cabinet meeting the story about Catherine Zappone. We'll explain that to you in detail in a while, but it's a fascinating aspect of the whole thing. And then the Sunday World and the Sun on Sunday are both leading with the release from prison of Derek Hutch. And by the way, the Sunday Telegraph, and this is on the front of the other English papers as well, shopping vouchers to boost youth jabs. So the unvaccinated will be given money off groceries and free pizza after their first dose to revive ailing rollout. And by the way, we are keeping an eye on events in Tokyo and Jackie Hurley is standing by there for us. And I think that the men's pommel horse final that Reese McLennan in might be slightly delayed, but we should be seeing a result from that sometime in the next hour. So we will keep an eye on that. My panel today, Anthony Staines is a professor of public health systems at DCU. Nora Casey is a broadcaster and publisher. And Paul Hosford is a political correspondent with the Irish Examiner. Good morning, everyone. Good morning. And you're all very welcome. And you all picked out, there were various pictures in the paper and everything. And I think there was a great sense of joy about this when you see that they're stalling in the UK and having to offer incentives to young people to get jobs. And we saw those massive queues yesterday. And of course, we love being the best at everything in Ireland. We've passed out the UK in the vaccine. That was a sore one with us and we've passed them out now. So now we can be happy. But Anthony Staines, it must have done your heart good to see those young people queuing up yesterday.
Oh yeah, it did. I mean, the sight of people queuing from 6 a.m. to get immunisation is just incredible. And it just shows the level of public spirit of young people in this country, because they get a lot of stick. They get a lot of stick from the media, they get a lot of stick from politicians, but actually they are amazing. And the things they do are amazing. And this is just one example.
Paul, is it that public spiritedness or is it that they want to go on their holidays and they want to be able to go inside?
I think it can be both.
Yeah.
I think Anthony's right, though. I think that if you look at this generation of teens, they've, you know, what they've gone through in the last couple of years has been absolutely unbelievable. You know, it's been tough for all of us. But if you're missing those formative events, if you're missing, you know, the likes of your Debs or your junior cert or your leaving cert, those things that you're supposed to be doing at these times, it can be very difficult. And to be willing in your absolute thousands, first day, you know, from 6 a.m. yesterday morning, to give back or to get protected from this virus. And we know that teens generally won't get very sick with this. So them getting vaccinated is pure selflessness, regardless of their motivations. I mean, one of the things is we've constantly been told, or sometimes it can appear through the media, and we do make a mistake sometimes in this, that buy-in to this vaccine rollout is low, or that it's 50-50, or that it will fall off a cliff. But if you look at the age statistics, you know, 99% over 80s, 98% 70 to 79, 96%. But then when you get down to the 30 to 39%, 82% of people have had one dose already. And that portal only opened about 3 weeks
ago. Yeah, and that's probably not complete.
Absolutely. There's still people getting there. And then 20 to 29% who were only able to register within the last 10 days, 64% of people have already had their first dose. The buy-in is huge. And the idea that it's not, or the idea that we won't reach that 80 or 85%, it isn't borne out in the statistics. And the teens who showed up yesterday will probably help us get to close to 80% overall population.
Yeah, yeah. Nora, you're nodding along there.
I am, because I'm a sandwich generation person, as in I live with the young adults, obviously Dara, who just got vaccinated for the second time last week. And I know how difficult life has been for him. Like, I have no idea why it was so emotional to watch those young teenagers yesterday. But
it was, though, wasn't it?
It was. Yeah, it was like I would cry at anything, like, you know, the Andrex puppy dog advert. But I was looking at the queues and the photos going up on social media, and God, I had a big lump in my throat thinking, God, how great they are, you know, that they come out, any teen, to get out at 6 a.m. in the morning and queue. And maybe the cynics are saying it's because of Electric Picnic, but I don't think so. I do think that we raise good kids in Ireland, and
yeah,
you know,
I think they're better than we were at
certainly better than
I was at their age. Absolutely, they seem like a nicer bunch of people all around.
Yeah, but there may be more.
I wouldn't be up at 6 in the morning any day for any reason at the age of 16 or 17.
Yeah.
This is Greta Thunberg's generation.
Yeah,
and if you look at what's happening to the planet, that's what they're dealing with. They have woken up faster than we did.
Yeah.
They're much more self-aware than I was, or probably than you were at that age. And that's a huge change. But they're going to need it for the challenges that face all of us.
Yeah, yeah. In terms of the vaccination, so everyone here fully vaccinated, I presume, at this stage?
I'm getting my second dose on Monday, so.
Oh, yeah. Good man. Anthony, this is the first time that I've seen you in here, that I've seen your face.
Yes. So you have. Me too.
And I'm taking this, like, you know, they talk about the lipstick index or this or that. I'm thinking of the Staines mask index. This gives me great hope for things. So you have decided that you can now be a little less cautious, have you?
Yeah, I think I'm fully vaccinated. I'm still at high risk because of my other conditions. But I'm now.
What other conditions have you?
I had cancer about 20 something years ago and ended up with multiple liver transplants. It's a very long story. But I'm immunosuppressed because of that, and I have chronic kidney disease because of that.
Okay.
So for those reasons, I'm it's slightly higher risk than the general population, and I'm 60, which doesn't help. But you know, in the networks I move in, everybody's vaccinated. My kids are vaccinated. They're in their 20s. Their friends are vaccinated. All my relations are vaccinated. I don't go out very much still, and I won't for a while. I was never a nightclub person. I'm not really missing the nightclubs, I have to say.
Yeah.
The number of cases has been stable in Ireland. I am worried about Delta, but over the last couple of weeks, the number of cases has been stable. If we can get them down, we could do very nicely. There is a concern both here and in Britain that the number of cases might go up when schools go back in September. Because that's the big unvaccinated group of people, is primary school age children and secondary school age children. But you know, we're making inroads into the secondary school age children, and there are studies underway in primary school age children. There's some results out, but probably a little too soon to bring it to the regulatory authorities to say, can we vaccinate this age group? But that will come, I think.
Okay. But you think we are on the road out of this and that vaccination will deliver us out of this, do you?
If there's no new variants. I mean, if there's a new variant, all bets are off. And we're taking some risks getting a new variant because there's so many cases globally. Mm. We had 300,000 cases here on yesterday. That was our, we tipped over that number. Mm. But that's a halfpenny place compared with many other parts of the world. So one of the reasons we were so strong on pushing vaccination everywhere, you know, we don't know where the next new variant will come from. Mm. We don't want to find out. We don't want to find out what's the range of variants of COVID-19. We don't want to explore the full space of COVID-19. You know, it's like dogs. Dogs come in all sorts of sizes and shapes. You don't necessarily want to produce the most unpleasant, most vicious, nastiest dog you can. You can do that by bad breeding, but we don't want to do that with this virus.
Nor are you living your life?
No, I'm working very hard, which has been kind of part and parcel of my life. I'm a business owner and I lost my editor at the beginning of January. So needs must roll my sleeves up. So I'm probably doing her job and a few other people's jobs at the moment. So not living my life. But I still remain a little bit confused as to, you know, today, even across the papers, there's a lot of contradictions. You know, the page one of the Mail is, you know, hailing the great ending of the vaccination centres and
that the reopenings. Page one of the Business Post.
Page one of the Business Post. Sorry, Brendan, you're right. And then you, I was really interested in Rachel Lavin's piece, and maybe Professor Staines knows more about it. So it was on page 12, Britain Calls for Hope, with a drop in daily case numbers in the UK. Now, you said earlier, we're always very competitive against the British and the whole headlines today are we've eked ahead of them. This one says the number of confirmed cases has fallen by more than a third, by 38% since Freedom Day on July 21. So is that an element of herd immunity? Like we sat here saying those crazy Brits opening the doors and the picture, I nearly had a lump in my throat watching the picture because it was loads of people crammed together in Soho and you just wouldn't see the likes here. In fact, we'd be putting them on Twitter and, you know, castigating them. So Is there an element of truth in that? They say the Northern Ireland numbers are going down since Freedom Day.
Northern Ireland numbers are high and they're higher than ours. But British case numbers are going down, which is great. It's what everybody wants. Whether they're why they're going down is a bit more unclear. And I don't think anybody really has a good handle on it. Some of it's vaccination. Some of it's previously unidentified infection. It looks like the rate of infection in the British population was higher than anyone thought it was.
Rachel Lavin mentions in that piece in the Business Post that the ONS, who do a lot of this survey work, surveyed 100,000 people at one point and 92% of them had antibodies to COVID.
Yeah.
It's extraordinary, isn't it?
It is. It's a lot higher than people thought.
Yeah.
Could it be the same here?
We don't know. Hopefully.
It's interesting. I thought that was a really interesting read, you know. I hadn't thought of it before, you know, just in terms of, I know that was, you know, the highest risk strategy and there's part of me that doesn't like the idea of, you know, tampering with people's lives. And although we have great protection against severe illness, nonetheless, you know, the Delta variant does cause difficulties for people. You can see that in the hospitalisation. So going full hog and saying, let's reopen completely, I do have an anxiety about it. And then I look at that piece by Rachel Lavin and I think, wow, are they right and are we wrong? I'm only pondering the question because it's what I'm saying to myself.
Again, we are, Paul, like you were looking at that front page of the Business Post as well. We do seem to be now proceeding with a little less caution, are we? Is the government not as afraid as it was?
I suppose I would be loath to say less caution because the watchword in government circles is still very much caution. And they've said from the get-go, or particularly over the last few weeks, whatever we do, we'll do in line with public advice, public health advice. I suppose the real game changer was that NPHET briefing during the week where Tony Holland was very positive about what the future, or what the coming 6 to 8 weeks would bring.
Yeah. I think did that kind of embolden the politicians a little bit, you think? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And it cleared the horizon a little bit. It made them feel like, you know, the next period of reopening or the next decision on reopening would probably be the start, first or second week of September. So you're talking 6 weeks to kind of keep an eye on what Delta does, on case numbers and how they link to hospitalizations and ICU admissions. And having you know, that having the CMO be positive obviously makes you think that maybe the industries that aren't open. And, you know, we sit here and we talk about indoor dining returning, or we talk about the reopenings that we have had. There are businesses, there are people who will be listening whose businesses haven't opened all year and have no clarity on when they might open in the live music industry or children's play centres, indoor sports facilities, the likes of those. They'll probably be thinking, you know, when am I going to get some clarity? What they heard from Tony Holohan on Wednesday would have been very, very positive for them. Mm-hmm. Within the government, it was just, you know, no concrete plans came from it. There was nobody saying, right, well, we can do X, Y and Z on September the 12th.
But it's a change of tone. Mm.
Absolutely. Yeah. And for the first time, you get the sense that the government, some within the government are thinking, maybe we can start planning beyond COVID. And maybe, you know, looking into next March or April, where as a time where it might not be a thing where we're reading about it every day, where it's, it's, you know, not a piece of history, but something that we're not living with as immediately as we are now.
Yeah, you're nodding along with that, Anthony. You see, I'm quite taken aback at what I feel is a huge change in tone from you since maybe the last time I saw you. Yeah. You're clear, like you were quite, I won't call it pessimistic, like, but at a lot of times here when there were seemed to be green shoots breaking out, and you would come in and, you know, you might be, I won't call it apocalyptic, like, but you would say, look, hang on a minute here, let's not lose the run of ourselves. You've clearly changed your thinking on that.
I think what we've done here, which has gone really well, is we've had one of the best vaccination campaigns in Europe.
Yeah.
And that's fantastic. That's an amazing achievement. We are still, we don't know what's going to happen with Delta in September. That's probably the big unknown question. What happens when schools go back? Now, hopefully, nothing happens when schools go back. That's what everybody wants. But I think we just need to be a little bit careful that we don't get ourselves, if we got into a position where case numbers are starting to go up again, coming up to September, that would not be a good place to be going back to school.
Yeah.
Because we know children spread this disease. We know children transmit between themselves and to adults. They don't get sick with it particularly, not off or rather seldom, but they do spread it. So we're not out of the woods yet, but we are moving in the right direction. It's taken a very long time. It's cost a lot more than it should have. The cheapest strategy for this was always to control case numbers and vaccinate.
Yeah.
And we didn't do the first bit, but we did the second bit. And it worked. That has worked really well.
Okay.
So, I do, unless there's a new variant, a bad new variant, the end is coming up. And by Christmas, we should, with a bit of luck, we should have a normal enough Christmas. But it will probably be
back to like normality as we knew it before,
More or less, I think people will still be cautious. People will still stay further apart.
Well, Christmas now, I mean, you think staycations are dangerous. Christmas is a highly dangerous event. We know, we see the dangers now. Yeah. And I'm sure Tony Holohan and Paul Reid will be out to warn us of the many, many dangers of Christmas lights, everything. Nora, one of the things that's going to come up here, which you picked out there, it's a piece by it's by Alan O'Keefe in the Sunday Independent about the going back to the office, which there seems to be a lot of, well there doesn't seem to be any real clarity on that, is there?
I think I've been talking about this for a few weeks because there is a juxtaposition between people's privacy and your right to be safe in your workplace. So this is talking about ISME and IBEC, who are raising concerns about, you know, the timescale, how long it's taking for people to go back to the office. And we know that the government has stated that they wanted to see public servants, for instance, back in the office in September. Google has said they hope that it might be around October. And then that raised the issue of the vaccinated versus the unvaccinated. So the view on GDPR was, if you are unvaccinated, it's your choice. Of course it is, whether to be vaccinated or not, and your employer can't ask you as to whether you're vaccinated. However, if you are sitting next to the person who is unvaccinated, and we know that there isn't 100% coverage for you getting the Delta variant, then you're exposed in some circumstances to the unvaccinated person next to you. So ISME cites two cases. One is in a nursing home where a member of staff refused on religious grounds to be vaccinated and they couldn't redeploy her or him and had to let them go. And the second was a deli business where an employee decided that they didn't want to be vaccinated, and the other employees said they didn't want to work with that person. So they're building up cases really for the workplace commission rather than dealing with it in terms of there's a protocol which the government, the Department of Enterprise, Trade and Employment brings out about the safety about return to work. It looks like the state departments are, nobody has one ownership of this. You know, obviously the health department is responsible for vaccinations, but the Department of Trade and Industry and Employment is responsible for employees. So I feel that
So there's been no clear guidance on which takes precedence here.
I think it's going to be difficult.
Is this going to be the next omni-shambles for them, Paul, in terms of like mixed messaging and not a clear plan? Are they going to get caught on the hop by this again when suddenly there are a million plus people whose, I think, bosses very badly want them back in the office?
Yeah, I think I'm not going to say that it will be an omni-shambles. It's what they would call in football terms a potential banana skin. It's a game against Luxembourg at home that you should win. Look, the government has kind of been, I'm not going to say forthright, but they have kind of said that September, October is when they would like to see people start to go back. We know that there's a knock-on effect in the wider economy of people not being in offices. If you've been around Dublin City at all during all of this, you'll know that the likes of the cafe that normally just serves office staff, the you know, those kind of businesses, they rely on having footfall, and without people in the offices, they're really, really hurting. But I think that the big thing is we're going to have that conversation nationally and as a society about whether or not your freedom to not get vaccinated trumps the person beside you's freedom to be protected from the virus, and that's a really big
and
moral
your freedom
quandary.
For nobody to know about your health information.
This is it, and it's those dueling interests between, you know, your privacy and their safety, and it's a conversation that the government has to have internally over the next 3 or 4 weeks because a mass return to the offices isn't really on the cards. It's going to be in dribs and drabs, and I think people are still. You touched on Christmas there. There's a mass trauma that the country has gone through. People are going to be the vast majority of people are going to be watching their behaviour for the next few months, and that's going to be, you know, you're going to have to be a little bit more, a little bit more aware of other people's boundaries. So if you get on a train, not to stand so close to somebody because they might not be as comfortable as they were, you know, last January, or you know, if your friends don't want to go to mass gatherings or to big events, that's going to take some time to come back to. And we're going to see all of these strands have to
be pulled
out.
Somebody in England was telling me that they feel terrible pressure now if you're not out partying and you're not doing this and that, your friends are all like, what's wrong with you? And you're a bit of a spoiled sport now. Anthony, you wanted to come in there.
One thing to remember, the knock-on goes both ways. There's a load of businesses in the suburbs and in small towns doing huge business. And a lot of people are finding that spending an hour, 2 hours a day commuting is not very productive. So productivity in some businesses has gone up sharply. And I think we're going to need to find a new balance between where you work, and the technology has improved to support that.
Okay.
So mixed working.
Yeah. Okay, guys, and we're going to interrupt this riveting discussion to go to another riveting discussion in Tokyo. Jackie Hurley is there for us. Jackie, news from the men's pommel horse final.
Yeah, and unfortunately, Brendan, it's disappointment for Reese McLenaghan. He went second last, knew what he had to do. Unfortunately, when he got up on the pommel, it just has not gone his way. I don't know if it's nerves, whether it's the wrist injury that he's been carrying this year, but he ended up coming off the pommel. And I don't know if you were watching it back there, but you could just see the devastation on his face. He has talked all the time about chasing the gold medal, and unfortunately, he's going to come away with none. I don't know if you've seen it, but just your heart would break for him.
No, really, and he was very ambitious, wasn't he, and high hopes.
Yeah, he was. And like, look, he has said all along that his childhood dream was to come here and win an Olympic gold medal. And I think, you know, it's very rare that we have Irish people who are so bullish about speaking about winning like that. You know, we've had lots of Olympic success in the past, but even you saw with Aidan Walsh the way he celebrated winning bronze, and you know what it means to people. For Reese, his ultimate dream is to be the best in the world. You know, he has talked about that being making the pommel something for kids to dream about doing in Ireland. And Look, I mean, he's the youngest in the field. He's only 22. You know, of the eight finalists there today, Max Whitlock has just won it. Back-to-back Olympic gold medals for him. But I just think for Rhys, it's just utter devastation because he has put so much into this and he definitely has the talent. It's just now a case of how he picks himself up again for Paris.
Yeah, yeah. And like in that moment, as you say, he just didn't go right for him. And listen, Rory McIlroy just missed out on a medal. But I think philosophical about it, we just before we talk about it, Jackie, let's have a listen to this clip from Rory talking afterwards.
I've never tried so hard in my life to finish third. You know, I give it my all out there today. You know, proud of how I played this week and how I competed, and I'll look back at this week, but nothing but great memories.
Yeah. So your overall thoughts on the Olympic experience?
It's been brilliant. Yeah. It really has. Just everything about it. You know, it's not just another golf tournament. You know, put it that way. You know, you're a part of something that's much bigger and. I'm really looking forward to Paris in 3 years' time.
That's Rory McIlroy talking to Gary Moore. Jackie, we have a convert there. I mean, he would have been viewed as a somewhat reluctant Olympian, but I heard him talking earlier in the week as well. He's clearly caught the bug, has he?
Oh my God, he was loving it. Did you see him playing with Shane Lowry yesterday? Yeah, they were going around fist bumping each other, absolutely living their best life out here. And I think anybody who's been chatting and watching Rory McIlroy this week, the other weird thing is, Brendan, because there's no crowds here, you're literally right up beside them. So like a couple of the lads from the office went out and watched yesterday and was just saying that just how relaxed he was and how much he was enjoying it. And you can hear him there talking to Gary. He was saying he's already looking forward to Paris and just how much he's enjoyed it. I think it's probably surprised him a little bit as well about how much he enjoyed it, because I'd say he thought, the Olympics, sure, whatever about it. But actually, you know, he said he's never fought so hard for third. Like, it was a playoff, it was absolutely mad stuff, 7 of them in a playoff. It ended up going to 4 playoff holes, and he really, really went for it. Which, look, it's unfortunate he didn't win a medal. He came incredibly close, tied 4th, but I think when he reflects on his Olympic journey, he'll be delighted that he came.
Yeah, you see, I wonder, is it when you take the money and the commercialism out of it or something, does it free the player up to have a different kind of experience or a different, you know, for someone like him, like?
Yeah, and look, the other thing is, I think just golf itself, like, imagine if it was a team event and you would have had Lowry and McIlroy playing for individual, but actually a team event yesterday. If that was the case, you'd have had Ireland right in the mix of it as well, which would be brilliant, like Ryder Cup style, which I think people would love. But I think you're right about the commercialism. Like, there was a lot of questions about McIlroy and why he wasn't wearing a hat, whether it was because Nike wouldn't let him. And he actually was quite funny, even in his press conference. He came out during the week and said, "No, lads, it's actually nothing to do with that. It's actually because I've got a really small head and my hat, they don't fit me." So, you know, he's been in really good form this week as well. And we've seen a lot of, I suppose, the warmer side of Rory McIlroy, which, you know, like, it's tough when you're on a professional tour every week and you're getting questions fired at you all the time. But he was definitely really, really relaxed this week.
Okay. Now, so what we have left of Super Sunday, is Thomas Barr in action later on in the 400 metre hurdles semi-final, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's been a super disappointing Sunday so far, hasn't it? So here's hoping that Tom Barr lights it up later on. The other thing is, it is absolutely sweltering down there. It got up to 43 degrees. I don't know if you have seen Greg Allen or Dave Matthews on social media or David Gillick, but it's worth a look because they're half the men that they were when they left there yesterday, because it is just so hot down there. And I don't even know how competitors are continuing to go. As the evening progresses, it does get a little bit cooler. I suppose for Tom Barr, look, he was such a superstar in Rio, and I think if he could make an Olympic final, it would really bounce this Sunday back, because it's been difficult. The other really cool thing that happened last night, I don't know if you were watching it, but they put the track into darkness, and then they sort of projected this like a hologram onto the track, which was really cool. It was this lovely planned thing, but it happened right after the Irish relay team had been in action. So as they came through the mix zone, Ken Fogarty, our cameraman, and David Gillick were doing the interview. So the whole stadium is in darkness. The RTE camera crew nearly caused an international scene as we had the light on interviewing them, and the stewards came running over saying, "Lads, turn off the light, turn off the light." So in fairness to the relay team, they stuck around and did the interview afterwards, but there was nearly an incident down there. In fairness, I think David Gillick had to be on his best behaviour to try to calm the stewards down.
Look, the Irish always make their mark. Jackie Hurley, thanks a million for that.
Cheers, Brendan.
Bye, Jackie. Have we all been following the Olympics religiously? Anthony, you're big into sport, aren't you?
No, I'm not. Not religiously at all, but okay. I've been very impressed by the bits I've seen. I mean, the women's Cox's fours was just extraordinary to watch. It's an extraordinary sport to watch. And the fact that we got a bronze medal in it is really impressive. For a bronze medal in boxing, a sport about which I know essentially nothing.
Yeah,
but it's still very, very good. And a gold medal in rowing. So that's impressive. And we have a lot of people. For a small country, we have a lot of people in the Olympics. We have a lot of really great sports people.
Yeah. Something else we've heard of. Paul, have you been following religiously?
Yeah. I've been on late this week. So the timing has actually really suited me. I can get up and kind of watch what's going on. And then when work is over, you can kind of tune into the later stuff. Like Anthony said, I think three medals is already a huge achievement. But one of the things that we have to be careful with the Olympics is that we don't boil it down to medals. We have 116 athletes there, the largest team we've ever sent. We're talking about potential. We're disappointed we didn't win a gold in pommel horse. You know, a sport that none of us would have really paid any attention to until this year.
Yeah.
You know, we're rowing. We didn't have an Olympic medal till 2016. Yeah. We're you know, the mixed relay. We never really would have looked at an event like that and said we could do something there. You know, we're looking at sports that we were never looking at before, and we're saying, you know, we could do something here. You know,
listen, there's no doubt every kid in Ireland is going to want to be out rowing now. Obviously we've had it for the last few years, but I think this year really has probably done a lot for rowing.
Absolutely. But you also have to remember one of the things about Ireland that's really, really special is that we've sent 116 athletes to the Olympics. We have one of the best men's rugby teams in the world. We have a women's rugby team that's always competitive. We've got a soccer team that, while they sometimes disappoint, are always in the top 50 in the world. We have four national sports that are massively played. We had, you know, big results in European championships in baseball recently. We play, you know, all minority sports from table tennis to American football, and we compete at, you know, far above our level. So to have three Olympic medals and all of those other things is an astonishing achievement.
Yeah, Nora, I don't know if you saw, Lucinda Creighton had a piece in the Business Post today talking about the fact that on one hand, there's all that, and on the other hand, we're the second most obese nation in Europe. And is there some way of putting those two things together where we look to these people to inspire kids and to encourage them and get kids moving a bit more, you know?
When I was younger, like, we played the Olympics every year in the Phoenix Park, me and my brothers and sisters. We had our own pommel horse. So, you know, I think that looking at extreme athletes, to me, I was not a sporting child and I don't religiously watch the Olympics. I still got a real high out of, you know, especially Paul O'Donovan's comments when he won. It was so Irish, you know. Sure, you know, it was all right, really. I wouldn't be bragging about it, you know. It was so lovely. And I don't think that ordinary people living their lives are going to find a connection to that. That's the truth, because they're just at the other end of the spectrum to the rest of us.
It's funny now. I think of all the things you might find a connection with, it's the Olympics. Like, I actually found, sounds ridiculous, but I've started running, right? And my running was getting slower and slower. My 5K was degenerating, like. And this week, I did actually find myself going, go on, push yourself a little bit. Like, look at all these guys. They push themselves a little bit. Don't be lazy about it. And actually, you know,
Brendan, you're wired differently. They're totally wired differently.
There's another bit to it, though. Who's obese? Obesity in Ireland is largely poverty.
Yeah.
It's largely driven by poverty. And the schools, the systems in the places where poor people in this country live are underfunded, under-resourced. If I want to play sports, I live out in North County Dublin. Every sport known to God or man is within a kilometre of my house. If I live in the North Inner City, there's hardly any playing fields in the North Inner City.
And there's issues around funding and pricing.
Class issue there.
And there's a drop-off issue as well, particularly with girls.
Yeah.
And I think one of the messages that you have to send kids, particularly when they get to 16, 17, 18, is that even if you're not going to go and make a living out of this, keep playing, keep going. You know, we see it in GAA all the time. If you're not a county minor, by the time, you know, you've probably no interest in going playing junior football afterwards. There has to be that bridge, and there has to be efforts to, particularly with girls, young girls, teenage girls, to keep them involved in sport.
Just to give a little plug to Jackie Hurley, it's a book coming out, actually, a brilliant book on young women, and so, you know, to try and encourage young women in sport, actually, by showing all the wonderful female sporting icons we have in Ireland. So
yeah, and we certainly have a lot more of them now, and much more visible than they were. Okay, our panel staying with us, Anthony Staines, Nora Casey and Paul Hosford. We'll take a quick break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel still with us, Anthony Staines, Nora Casey and Paul Hosford. Now, I suppose in a way, Paul, you were talking about the government looking beyond COVID a bit and the real world again and real politics and everything. Catherine Zappone, probably a taster of real life politics. Before we get into the meat of that, just on the story today, which was in the Irish Times yesterday, advanced on the front of the Sunday Independent. Can you just explain, this is a sidebar to it, but it's kind of interesting too, that how the leaker was apparently caught out.
Yeah, so in Jodie Corcoran and Hugh O'Connell's story, they outline that a junior minister was dispatched to tell a senior minister that they had been on radio talking about the Catherine Zappone appointment as special envoy for freedom of expression. The junior minister then got a text from a journalist saying, "We heard you were just on the radio locally giving out about this Zappone appointment." They had relayed that information to the senior minister, but they hadn't actually been on the radio.
And he'd only told this to one person.
Told it to one senior minister, and then was able to go back to the Taoiseach Leo Varadkar and say that they'd essentially caught the leak. The story says that the junior minister that relayed the information would have been an ally or perceived ally of the senior minister, but is a true blue Fine Gaeler and believes that leaks are hurting the party. So a fairly lengthy or a fairly elaborate way of finding a cabinet leaker, but
yeah,
one that seems to have been successful.
But look, this—it has caused a lot of trouble for them, and particularly, I think, Simon Coveney, as Michael Brennan, I think, says in his piece in the Business Post, that Simon Coveney essentially ended up as the spokesperson for Catherine Zappone last week, while Catherine Zappone, meanwhile, has said nothing. And Anthony, you were looking at that in the Mail on Sunday, John Drennan and Valerie Hanley, Zappone urged to explain role.
Yeah. And she's being asked to explain what's going on, what her involvement in it was. And there's been nothing from her side. It's the story that's being put forward by the government is that this is a post that they thought was necessary and that they felt Catherine Zappone would be a good person to fill it. And it's hard to argue that she doesn't have the right experience for it. It doesn't seem to have been advertised. It doesn't seem to have been widely discussed outside the government, outside government circles. So just as state board appointments were filled internally and on the quiet until 10 or 12 years ago, it seems that these appointments are still filled in that way. And that's probably the root cause of the problem. If this was advertised, if they said, "We want a spokesperson on this," then people could come forward
and
put themselves forward.
Big ads in the paper for, "We're looking for somebody who's maybe living in New York, because we're not spending money to send someone out there. They get 15 grand a year. They need to have experience in XYZ, and we're looking for them as a special envoy." Like,
yeah, you could.
Yeah.
There are people who could. No problem whatever with Catherine Zappone doing this. She seems a very sensible choice. But there may well be other people who could do it. And at least if you did that, even if you only got one application, other people have the opportunity to put their hat in the ring if that's what they want to do.
Okay, so process the issue here. Nora.
Just to say on that, there is a public appointment system. So I'm on that email database. So all day, every day, I get notifications for public appointments. It doesn't cost a cent. They don't have to put any big, splashy ads in order to let people know that there's a system available. Anybody can register for public appointments.
And there's a high-level appointment service as well. So if you wanted to take it out of that general sphere, you could say, look, this is a very specialised job, but we're gone the right way about it.
This is a very August story, and it'll rumble. Mm. Not necessarily because, you know, exactly like what Anthony Staines has just said, I have no issue with the person. I do have a huge issue with the process. Yeah. On this occasion, yes, it was a woman that was chosen, but 99.9% of occasions, it's a man, not a woman. And we spent the year with Catherine Day looking at gender equalities. I sit on a forum with the Dáil, set up by the Ceann Comhairle, looking at family-friendly policies and how to get gender balance, especially in our public appointment system. So if you're going to use a system like this, which is who you know and whether you've got a good man or a woman for the job, then that's not about equality. It's certainly not equality about diverse communities and everything else that goes with it. Then you add the layer on top of, in the cabinet, one of Paul's colleagues is tweeting out the fact that the appointment is going to be put to the cabinet.
One of the colleagues of told someone else while the meeting was still going on.
Yes,
who then tweeted. Danny McConnell then.
But then Justine McCarthy adds another layer today on page 12 of the Sunday Times. She's talking about the cronyist appointments, lack of moral authority. But also what she's revealing is on Monday, there was obviously a very significant brief given to the Irish Times. Until I read it, I'd completely forgotten the story, but they had a very full account on the lead on page one of the Irish Times on Tuesday, but all these appointments Simon Coveney was putting to the cabinet that day, including the government secretary general, Martin Fraser, Niall Burgess and others. And she said the detail was so specific, it was all but the chocolates that they were going to be serving when they became ambassadors in various countries.
Yeah.
And at no point in that briefing did they mention this particular appointment. So she's saying to ignore it twice, you know, overlook giving it to the Taoiseach, that's one thing.
It could have been a little bit more than careless.
Yeah, so I do feel that there's, you know, obviously there's politics at play here and there's issues, underlying issues that it has. I mean, actually, Eilidh O'Hanlon doesn't put her punches on page 22 of the Sunday Independent about free speech and the irony, the barefaced gall, she says, of the government to appoint an envoy for freedom of expression, and goes on to castigate the government about its track record this year on freedom of expression.
And Catherine's opponent, I think, is very in favour as well, or has been on the record as saying that she believes that she's very much in favour of hate speech, so-called, being clamped down on, very much in favour of social media companies clamping down on free speech.
Yeah, and then there's also, I suppose, defamation laws. There's a lot in the papers today about that with RTE. So, you know, you have to look at when one person's hate speech is another person's freedom of speech. It's a very fine line. And I think, is there a need? I personally, you know, I'm one of those people who always stands back from it and said, is there a need for us to have a special envoy on freedom of speech?
Well, Paul, do we know what this job is? Because there seems to be some suggestion there's an LGBT connection to it as well. Then it's an envoy to freedom of speech. I saw somewhere it has no formal connection with the UN or anything.
No, it generally kind of seems like the terms of reference for the job are fairly broad. In that it takes in, you know, these kind of, I suppose, non-specific and flowery kind of, it's freedom of expression and freedom of speech. What we're actually going to get for the you know, people have argued Catherine's opponent will be value for money, but I think unless we actually line up that actual, you know, the actual specifics of how the job is going to be done, what are we looking for out of this? Is it just somebody who can go and represent us at UN gigs in New York? If that's the case, there's a consul general there. There's an ambassador in Washington. We have those things.
You know, now, Simon Coveney was very clear with Brian Dobson on Friday that Catherine's opponent would have targets, that she would check in with him and answer to him every 6 months or something, I think he said, and that, you know, there would be a structure to this there. She wasn't just like off out there doing her thing.
Yeah, but in the same interview, he didn't give those exact targets. So, you know, it's the same. It comes back to the same thing of not advertising it. If you advertise a job, you have to come up with a job spec. You have to come up with what the role entails. And then when you sit down, like, you've kind of forced yourself to interrogate. So we need somebody to do X. They need to do Y and Z and have, you know, capabilities A, B and C. And if you'd have done that, and if Catherine's opponent had come forward and said, I would like to do that and here are my bona fides, you just said, okay, well, that's the process.
Do we have any other special envoys or?
The special envoy positions exist. You know, this isn't the first time we've ever done it. But I suppose the issue here is the process. It's not the person. It's, you know, I think a lot of people are more upset about how this is done and how it looks. The optics of it are really, really bad. And when
it's funny though, a lot of Fine Gael, there were a few Fine Gael quotes saying that, you know, they didn't see why a Fine Gael person could have done this job. It seemed to miss the point about cronyism, like that it was the wrong crony in a way. Is this a problem for them, Paul?
I think I'm probably minded to agree with Nora in that it's probably an August story. The problem is that it exposes a fault line in the coalition. In that, what you know, one of the reports during the week that we had was that Fine Gael ministers knew about this, but the Taoiseach didn't, and that implies that the work that's going to cabinet is siloed. That, you know,
Well, again, now as Simon Coveney explained, there would be a meeting of the Fine Gael ministers before cabinet to run through everything, and they were made aware of that, but he said that was like 20 minutes before the
these kind of they're not ad hoc, but they're a lot quicker. But the leaders meet every Monday before cabinet, and they had a meeting on Monday because they discussed the level of guests that would be allowed at weddings. So they were discussing things that would be brought up at cabinet.
As we know as well, there were, I don't know, it went from 41 to 46 to 60 items there.
Absolutely. And the agenda at cabinet can be fairly fluid, and sometimes people might not have it until, you know, 10 or 15 minutes beforehand.
Yeah.
But if I was in Fianna Fáil, and particularly you get the sense from some of the backbenchers, is that the fact that it was flagged in a meeting beforehand but not flagged until it got to the cabinet table left a bit of a sour taste.
Did they feel their man has been disrespected, Anthony?
There might be more of a consequence than that.
Yeah.
This is sending a message about the way that government wants to work. And this isn't really a party political point. We're looking at what Jean Kerrigan says about Davy stockbrokers, looking at the several articles on housing this weekend. There's a very strong sense that the economic and social system works for some people.
Okay.
It works really well. And that's dangerous. We can see in the United States, and to an extent in the United Kingdom, where that can lead. And that ties in with your comments, because I would think I would have slightly different views from you on hate speech. I think you can use hate speech to secure political power. And we've seen that in Hungary, for example. And it's extraordinarily dangerous.
I think one of the things about the way that the system works, and that kind of insider knowledge, is that most people in Ireland know that. You know, they know it in their bones, and they not accept it, but they kind of say, well, that's just how it is, and I'm not going to be able to tackle it. It's just the occasional reminder of it. And
you know what? This could have probably all gone fine if it wasn't for that pesky leak. You would think like that it just would have been some form of business as usual and could have,
I don't know that it would, Brennan. I don't think anybody out there believes that the Taoiseach, that it was just an oversight, given the level of detail about it. I mean,
but if it hadn't come to attention is what I'm saying. I'm not saying anything about the rights or wrongs of it.
It would eventually have come out that she had been appointed, and people would have questioned it, I think. You know,
okay.
Of course, there's other layers on it which adds more intrigue.
Listen, on something entirely different, and Nora and Anthony, you were both looking at this story in the Mail. I don't have it to hand now, Anthony, about the Magdalen Laundries and the memorial at the Sean McDermott Street Magdalen Laundry, isn't it?
Yeah, there's been. I went to school just up from there in Belvedere, and we used to walk past it every day. I never knew what it was. Never knew what was in it. But it was open till when I was a child. It was open when I was in school. And there's been a plan to have a memorial there for at least the last 8 years. And as far as I can see, and judging from what the papers say, there's been no progress in that at all. And the current rate of progress, you know, how many of the women who were there will still be alive when the memorial is put in? And I just think that's monstrously unfair. This is a group of women and babies who were ignored, sidelined and marginalised by the state for decades. It's about time we did some little bit of reparation for them. I see the redress scheme has been postponed again. It was meant to be considered at cabinet. It's not now going to be considered till cabinet meet again, which will be in 6 weeks or so. Further delays. How long will it take to bring it in? How long will it take to start it? What processes will be involved? How long will the applications take? You know, the delay piled on delay piled on delay is very disturbing. And we just need to stop. and at least building a memorial, that's something we should be able to do, and we should be able to do it properly so that the next generation of kids walking past that building will know what was in it.
Nora?
Well, as you know, I lost a chunk of my life in 2017 bringing the survivors, the remaining survivors of the Magdalen Laundries together, in line with what Justin Quirk had said back in 2013. At that time, he said the women should be allowed to meet and there should also be a memorial. He actually stated Sean McDermott Street. So it's very important to me. And I was down in Dublin City Council lobbying away with Gary Gannon, who's the inner city TD, who's been talking about it today in the papers. And finally, we got them to overturn a proposal to sell the site to Tokyo, which was a Japanese-based hotel group, for 14 million. And that was in 2018. I was there along with a group of the survivors. We had banners. We were cheering from the rafters. We thought everything was over. In fact, Niall Ring was the Lord Mayor at the time and very quickly convened a meeting with myself, some of the women survivors, some interested inner city people. I thought, all gung-ho, we're going to get somewhere here. There was lots of views being canvassed. And then fast forward to last year, Dublin City Council voted to allow it to be considered as a third level institution, something I and Gary and lots of others are in favour of. There'd been talks already with the national, you know, the university.
National College of Ireland.
Yes, National College of Ireland. I'm having COVID, you know, memory loss. So everybody thought that was a great solution because it would allow us to have a memorial on the site of the actual laundry itself. It's a huge, huge campus area for National College of Ireland. It would also allow for education to begin in an area of Dublin that badly needs that kind of stimulus.
Okay. Yeah.
There would be housing for older people. There would also be the ability for us to pull together an archive, which is something that we have always wanted, that future generations of children would be able to look at the archive. I mean, my son and his friends had never even known what a Magdalen survivor was until I had them all volunteering at that event. So it's very important that we have that. But nothing since. You know, every now and again,
do you know
I write
why?
From...
Do you know
who
what?
Knows?
So,
it's foot
so everyone seemed to be on board with that plan, and the survivors were on board with it as well.
Now, you have to... There is a garden, a beautiful garden being built in Hyde Park, at the laundry up in Drumcondra. There's a lovely statue out in Galway. There's various parts of the country. Sean McDermott is always seen as the sort of the centrepiece. It was registered as a sites of conscience, which is, you know, like the Gulag in Russia. There's various sites all over the world that are designated international sites of conscience. So very important. That was a very important designation for us here in Ireland. So I don't know. All I can say is foot dragging. There doesn't seem to be any impetus. As each Lord Mayor changed, you know, I found myself always phoning, writing, what's happening? Is there anything happening? I don't really know what's happening now. You know, I read, who was it during the week said that COVID has been used as an excuse for everything, when Michael D was faced with, you know, a huge deluge of bills to look at before the end of term. And the response he got was, well, it's because of COVID. And that's, I think, what, you know, ministers would say, it's because of COVID. I mean, it is since 2013. It's just a disgrace that we're still talking about it and not doing anything about it. I don't know whether there are things going on behind the scenes. Gary Gannon keeps his feet firmly on the ground and knows exactly what's happening in this space. So for him to say it should be signed over to the OPW, he obviously feels that there is some threat to this, you know, being delayed.
Okay. Before we go, the front page of the Sunday Times, Paul, and like it is a laughable notion in a way that they are putting in CCTV in the houses of the Oireachtas to make sure that people aren't like getting their friends to sign in for them.
Yeah, and a couple of TDs.
This sounds like Amazon or something.
It is, and it is one of those things. A couple of TDs and senators who I've been chatting to this morning have seen kind of the farcical side of it. I won't say the funny side of it. You know, the idea that they would have to be monitored going in and out of their workplace, which is the National Parliament, is a real sense of embarrassment. The piece in the Sunday Times does say, though, that while there's no evidence that the system is being abused, there's also no way of tracking who is fobbing in, so who is actually signing in to the Oireachtas. We're in 2021, like, you know, the likes of Amazon or, you know, any other business has biometric logins. You know, a couple of people I know, they clock in using their fingerprint, you know.
There seems to have been a discussion about having biometric and then they moved away from
This was kind of nixed on a GDPR kind of privacy grounds, which I suppose GDPR is one of the great get outs in the world. You can kind of just use it for everything. You can say it's a GDPR concern and people run a mile. So yeah, it is. Look, it's one of those things that we laugh about now, but when you think about it, the actual seriousness of it is huge. The fact that something like this has to be thought about, that we can't just take TDs and senators on their word that it is them that's clocking in or using their fob to enter the chamber and not their friends.
The other thing I'd say is, yes, that is laughable. And I do agree with you that it wouldn't happen in any other workplace. But one of the things we're considering as part of that Dáil Forum on Family Friendly Policies is online. You know, we're earlier in the conversation talking about people working, you know, from home. One of the big issues for women in particular and people, parents who are juggling childcare commitment, is that long commute in and out. Other parliaments do it and we should be able to do it rather than physically having, it's so old fashioned, you know, fobbing in and out of an actual building when you could be doing some of that remotely.
Okay, I think that could be a long way off. I think people like to see the parliament get together. All right, thank you very much, Nora Casey and Anthony Staines and Paul Hosford.